today I have with me in the studio Jonathan Wyman, who has spent most of his adult life in recording studios and now operates out of the Halo Recording Studio in Windham. Since returning to Maine to focus on independent records, he has collaborated with artists and labels from all over the country and the world, from northern Maine to Chennai, India. Nice to have you in here.
Thank you for having me.
Did I pronounce that correctly? Chennai?
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 Yeah.
I've never heard of it, but it's
on the, I think it's on the east coast of India. It used to be referred to as Madras.
Oh, that makes sense.
I got really super excited. I mean, it was a fun record to do, but I got really super excited to do like an Indian traditional record, and it turned out to be totally Western pop. It had nothing to do with Indian music aside from the guy who was singing.
So and it wasn't like a Bollywood thing?
Nope, not at all. Just a straight up pop record.
So do you find that a lot, that people that you're expecting that you're going to have some sort of cultural influence from some other place?
I mean, it's few and far between the international stuff, but it's interesting you say that, because this morning, one of the things that happens a lot is, I don't know what it is about my website, but I get a lot of calls from people who think I'm in Portland, Oregon. Maybe it's just because Portland, Oregon has a bigger indie rock scene. And a lot of recording studios, but I get multiple inquiries thinking I'm in PDX and not in PWM.
So what do they do when they find out that you are on the other side?
90% of the time it's, can you make any recommendations? But there have been a couple that I've actually done mix work for, which doesn't necessitate being in the same room now. People will mail me they'll send me electronically their multi-track files, and I'll mix them, and it's worked pretty well. I have two or three sort of repeat artists that I've worked with that found me sort of by accident, thinking I was a neighbor.
I'm interested in what you do, because I think most of us have a sense of, if you're a singer, you sing. If you're a guitar player, you play guitar. But you really, your instrument is kind of multivariate.
You're
working with a lot of sounds, bringing them together and creating something new out of them.
Yep, exactly. And that's one facet of it too. And the other facet of it is the organizational side of it, which can be just as time consuming and often more taxing. Coordinating multiple people, multiple opinions, even just multiple schedules these days. A lot of the artists I work with are independent artists who are still holding down jobs, and so getting people in the same room at the same time can be tricky. But as far as the technical side of it, the point of what I do is to take somebody else's work and bring it to its fullest potential. I think that's the best description of it.
How did you become interested in doing this?
When I was about 19, well, I guess even earlier, I would rent multi-track cassette recorders from Daddy's Junkie Music or Wurlitzer in Boston. And like over a school vacation, I would go, and like the Monday of vacation, I'd go and pick it up and drop it off the Friday and spend the whole week sort of holed up with a little cassette four track in the attic and working things out. And that probably would have been when I was 14 or 15, and there wasn't an internet there. You didn't know how to do it. You just had this, somebody behind the counter shoves this equipment in your hands and you go to it. In college, was in a band. We decided to make a record and go into a real studio, and to offset the cost of it, I was a grunt. I was a runner, and that turned into being an assistant, and then that turned into having my own sessions. And you know, I was still in college at the time, and then after college, came down to a commercial studio just outside of Portland. It just clicked. It seemed like the way that I could be making music all the time, because I wasn't the best player. I don't think I could make it as a player. But I felt good, and I felt like I could participate. It's sort of like being a little part in every band, you know what I mean? Like, I could participate in making music all the time in a studio situation.
Do you remember when you first were impacted by sound?
Sound or music?
Sound.
Sound.
Go with sound.
That probably would have been, you know, getting into teenage years at recording, there's that thing that happens when you start recording and you focus more on the technical side of it and the sounds than you do the actual emotional content or song content, at least for me. And I know a lot of people have had a similar sort of thing. But yeah, I think that would have been when I started, again, experimenting with those cassette four tracks and learning that I would always be in headphones because I couldn't disturb anybody else in the house. And so you had this really, really, you know, accurate representation of what you're hearing. You could hear everything. And I would move the microphone around a little bit around a guitar amplifier, and you could hear the differences in sound that these tiny little movements made. So I think that's my first sort of like obsessive moment, I think.
And what about music? It's interesting that you divided it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I think that you, people in my field can sort of divide the two terms, you know, and you can be really into things that sound good but have no musical impact or no emotional impact. And, you know, I definitely got into recording sound because I'm a musician, because I love music, and as a way to, broadcast is the wrong word, but just capture and translate. I think translate's the right word. Translate music into the best form possible. I've been involved in music forever. Singing, playing instruments. I went through a whole slew of, you know, the grade school instruments, playing cello, that wasn't right for me, and saxophone was a disaster. And it wasn't until like I was 12 or 13 and picked up an electric guitar that I was like, okay, I get this. I understand this. So,
I have two questions. One is that your definition of music, is something that has an emotional impact?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I good music. Music that I enjoy is, people always ask, what kind of music do you do? And that's a hard question. My sort of boilerplate answer is always just rock and roll, because it's so broad. But, you know, it can be anything as long as it, you know, makes you wiggle, as long as it connects with you on some level. That's what I consider good music. It can be hip hop, it can be metal, it can be just regular old rock and roll. But as long as it makes you react and makes you feel something, that's good music to me.
So then that leads me to my second question, which is, if it wasn't the cello and you knew that, it wasn't the saxophone, you knew that, why was it the electric guitar? Do you have any idea?
I remember seeing, in middle school, we had this thing called stage band, and it was almost like jazz band. It was terrible, but you had to audition for it. It was the better players, and I remember watching this guy play a guitar solo, and I was in the back of the auditorium. I was in the regular band, probably playing saxophone terribly, and I watched him play a guitar solo, and my memory of it is like he was the greatest. He was Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page and Andreas Segovia all rolled into one. And in actuality, you know, it's probably a semi-teenager limping through a mediocre jazz arrangement solo. But that was kind of the moment. That was when I said, I want to do that.
I always wonder what it is about a specific, say, sound that so captures someone.
Yeah.
I wonder how it is that someone's brain is wired.
Yeah.
That they can hear that.
Yeah.
And something wells up inside.
Yeah, and the guitar is such a weird instrument too, because it's like whereas a piano you have one location for each note. You know, you can play the same note in the same octave in four or five different places in the guitar, and you know there's no one telling you where the right place to do it, and each one has a slightly different sound. And physically, the guitar is a really stupid instrument. It like mathematically can never actually be in tune. And so many other physical aspects of it that can alter the intonation and the tuning of it. But that's what makes personality. You know, you think of a guy like Bill Frisell, who's one of my favorite guitar players, and, you know, he always plays stuff a little bit sharp, and it creates this tension that you instantly know it. It's like the sound of his voice.
So it's like a thumbprint or
exactly,
something.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's really interesting, not just on guitar, but on so many instruments, that you can identify a player within a couple of notes. I think it's a sign of a great player.
Which is kind of funny because we spend a lot of time in music, at least initially, trying to get people to sound a certain way to make sure that they've got the right notes and they've got the right foundation.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you do have to cross over. Like being an artist, like a visual artist,
sure.
you have to cross over and have your own thing.
And that happens, too, in terms of mixing, you know, to bring it back to what I do now musically, where you spend a lot of time, especially for me in formative years, sort of aping the people who I really like and admire and trying to make things sound like Chad Blake and trying to make things sound like Rich Costey. And I mean, I think it's a natural thing as an artist where you start off imitating and then it becomes your own voice and it becomes your own sound. I think a lot of people do that.
So is it similar for you that you have your own fingerprint?
That I don't
somebody
know.
Would
I don't
say,
know about
like,
that yet.
This has been done by Jonathan
Wyman. I don't know about that yet. I can't hear it. And in some ways, that's really good. Like, in some ways, there are the mixers that you can tell instantly, like, that is Chris Lord-Alge. I know that snare drum. But there's also, like I mentioned, Rich Costey before, and he might be sort of the person who I sort of look at and pay attention to the most these days, because I'm never certain that it's him, but I'll always hear a record and say to myself, that sounds great, and I'll go on the internet, because that's how you find credits these days, and I'll see who produced it or who mixed it, and it's, you know, 9 times out of 10 it's Rich Costey. It never screams this one identifiable sonic thumbprint, but it's always great.
So that's also kind of intriguing that that you don't know somebody by specifically what they are,
mm-hmm.
but more globally by kind of the sense of it.
And that everything on his CV is just top-notch, awesome stuff. And I think that's a great example of doing this job right. Like I said, it's about taking somebody else's work and making it as good as it can possibly be. It's like being a focusing lens. I think that's a good sign. I think not being instantly identifiable means that it's the artist that comes first. And the most important thing is finding the best things about what that artist is doing and bringing them to the forefront. And maybe, you know, if there's something weak or something that's not as successful, like either edit it out or downplay it.
So is your... Because I'm assuming you're very sensitive to sound, just in general,
mm-hmm.
as you're walking down the street. Like, what's that like for you?
Yeah, it's. I think the biggest thing is, and this is sort of, it goes around the internet now, but misophonia, the thing that happens when people are chewing and it drives you crazy, like that actually happens to me. And like if I'm working on something. And I don't listen very loud anymore because I want to preserve my hearing as much as I can. And I think you hear better at a moderate volume. If I'm working on something and there's somebody else in the room, and even if they're chewing gum or, you know, eating potato chips, like that instantly drives me crazy. Because I spend all day, especially if you're doing voiceover stuff or listening to just spoken content, you're actually trying to edit out all those little sounds. You're trying to get rid of it. You know, as far as the like walking out in the real world, it's interesting. I live downtown now. So it's a lot louder. It's like, traffic noise. Not so much in the house, but just walking around, I notice it a lot more. Not as bad. I used to live in Brooklyn, and I guess the subway is really bad for hearing. Like it's something like 95 decibels. If you're like, there are people who will actually actively wear hearing protection when riding the subway because it can cause actual hearing damage. It's that loud.
It's interesting you would say that because I think about riding on boats,
mm-hmm.
and the motor to a boat and how loud it can
yep.
really be. But because it's kind of so overwhelming that you don't even think, oh,
right.
this is a loud motor.
Yep.
And there's a lot of things like that, I
sure.
think, in our everyday life. And you, because this is what you do,
yep.
this is your ears are like your other people's hands, yep. for example, you would have to be even more careful.
Yep, I'm pretty careful about it. I try to wear earplugs when I go to shows. If an ambulance is going by, plug your ears or something. But you have to be careful because that's it. And once it doesn't grow back if you have hearing loss. And it even happens naturally, even if you take perfect care of your ears. I'm 41 years old. The high frequency, perception starts to dissipate a little bit. I definitely, not scientifically, but just listening to tones, I think I hear the upper echelon of human hearing a little less than I did when I was 22 now.
Well, that's a little discouraging.
It's natural. It happens.
So your wife, you and your wife both teach up at Bates.
She more than I. I do it once a year for 5 weeks at a time, and I don't think I'm going to do it this year. I don't think they're going to have me back. They got to sort of rotate the stock a little bit.
But you went to Bates.
I did.
Yourself.
Yep.
What have you noticed about the availability of access to the type of work that you do at colleges like Bates, at Bates specifically, or colleges like Bates?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that, it used to be on every laptop, but now it's even on phones and tablets. You have the technology to do the multi-track recording way, way, way beyond the level of the apparatus that I talked about earlier when I would go into Boston, rent equipment that I could only afford to have for a week at a time. Like, now that's on a phone. So it's pretty great. I think the ability to sort of learn about recording and the sort of editorial process as an artist and as a writer that recording can give you, that perspective where you can hear yourself, you can hear the songs, you can hear how you're performing it. That is, I think, a huge advantage to people who are coming up as artists today. Just being able to, just have access to the kind of technology that will give you that perspective on your own.
Well, I'm thinking about the photographers who used to do film mm-hmm. and now are digital. Mm-hmm. And there is a fair number of people who didn't really like that transition and resisted it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's a fair number of younger people who now go back and they learn
sure.
film. Is there any sort of equivalent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, coming up, we recorded everything to 2-inch analog tape. And you had 24 tracks, or 16, depending on the kind of tape deck. And tape was expensive. It's even more expensive now because fewer people are making it. But it had, there's all the romanticism about the quality of sound, the actual auditory experience of, magnetic tape. But I think the bigger thing comes in workflow and in the fact that, and maybe this is similar to film, where it's like, if you want to do that guitar solo again, we have to record over the guitar solo that's there. And that guitar solo is really good. And we can never get it back if we record over it. Because this is the last available track. This is the last thing we're doing on this song. So if you go in again, we're going to lose that forever. And obviously in digital, you have nearly unlimited tracks. You have these different playlists that you can do different versions of different performances and even compile them together into one Frankenstein performance. So that's definitely true in my field. And, in some ways, I sort of miss that level of commitment and that workflow that analog tape provided. Less so the maintenance. I think analog tape sounds good, but that's not the reason I get nostalgic for it. I get nostalgic for it, I think nostalgia is the wrong word, because I even this morning was thinking about, man, wouldn't it be great to have a room that was just tape and a console and maybe a couple of pieces of outboard gear and not these hundreds of choices that the digital environment provides you with. You can open a menu in Pro Tools, which is the recording software I use, and you have 25 different equalizers and 25 different compressors. And I think that can slow down creativity. I think you get way too wrapped up in all these different choices, and tape made you commit. And maybe that's the same thing with film, where you can't just shoot 1,000 times. You only have I don't know how many exposures you get per roll of film, but it's limited, right? There's a physical piece of film in there that you only can get so many exposures on. And then you have to develop them, and you have to, you know, as opposed to the instant gratification of the digital world.
Well, it's, as you're talking, I'm thinking about like the amount of prep time that used to be required before you would go in and record something. Mm-hmm. Because if you had a limited amount of mm-hmm. tape, then mm-hmm. you'd need to make sure you were pretty good by the time yeah. you got there. And now it's not that this is a good or a bad, but now you can almost prep as you're going.
Oh, it's definitely a bad. It's definitely a bad.
Okay, well, I didn't want to make
no,
that judgment.
No, I make that judgment. It's you get that sort of like, oh, you can fix it in Pro Tools. You can, you know, just get close enough and you can move the notes around digitally and make it right. And I don't like that. I think that, you know, recording is... It can be this really expensive, time-consuming thing, but there was this guy, Cowboy Jack Clement. He was a record producer, and he had his rules of recording, and the last rule was my favorite, and it was, it only takes 3 minutes to make a hit record. All you gotta do is be prepared, have a compelling performance, and that's it. It's not rocket surgery. Like, you get people who know how to play on the floor, and make a recording. So I think that the digital age has sort of fostered this, wow, I don't want to sound negative about it, but this lack of preparedness or this reliance on manipulating things as opposed to preparedness and performance.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And you think about even people who are learning music as they're coming up through, I mean, they can record themselves from the moment that they start yep. doing music, and they can start thinking, oh, well, I already sound good.
Right.
I don't really have to practice. I can
right.
just
right.
rely
there's
on...
There's a button that I can press that'll make all the notes be in tune, and if I can press that button, why would I need to practice?
Right. When we talked to photographer Trent Bell, he spends a lot of... And he photographs for Main Home Design. He spends a lot of time setting up the scene. So everything is exactly right in the house that he is photographing, and he has training as an architect, so it kind of makes sense that his mind works that way. But once it's done, it's done,
yep.
and he does very little editing afterwards.
Sure.
So I would think
that's a very similar, and I think that makes the best recordings. And you know, as far as preparation in the analog in my world would be, you know, make sure you've got the room set up. You don't want people sitting around. You don't want people getting bored. You know, if you can, have everything ready to go so they can walk into the room, put on headphones, and start playing immediately when the inspiration is there and everybody's still excited. It can be a really time-consuming, sometimes even boring process, doing the same thing over and over again. And part of what makes rock and roll great is the vitality and the spontaneity of it. And you don't get that when you're doing 20 takes in a row, trying to micromanage, you know, the snare drum sound and get it just right. So yeah, that's a really good analogy to what my level of preparedness has to be to get a great performance out of people.
So it is kind of about the energy.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like...
You can hear energy. You can hear people smiling. You can hear people having fun. And that's another part of my charge as a record producer, is to keep that happening and to make sure that people are still having a good time. Because you can hear people getting bored. You can hear people going through the motions. You can hear people overthinking themselves. I hear that the most with drummers, especially if drummers are playing to a click track or a metronome. I liken it to when somebody's walking on a balance beam and they're sort of, you know, picture the same thing, except instead of going left to right, it's, you know, forwards and backwards in time and trying to keep up with this little window of metronomic perfection. And you can really, really hear that and hear people paying more attention to being in time as opposed to, you know, speaking the part, if that makes sense.
Well, isn't there something that happens if you are prepared where there's just a flow?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of click into wherever you need to be and you just go.
Yep, absolutely.
So if you can just trust, if you prepare enough, you can just trust yourself.
Exactly.
That it's going to happen the way you need it to.
Yep, and just let it happen. Like some of the best stuff I've ever done does not sound at all like where we thought it was going to be when we walked in the room. So things are going to have a life of their own, and you always get these happy accidents, whether it's you open up a microphone that's in the wrong place and it sounds a certain way that informs a performance, and you can build an entire aesthetic of a song over a mistake like that, or over, you know, if somebody all of a sudden, I think somebody, I don't know how true this is, but the Paul Simon song 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, apparently the whole song was originally that disco beat that the choruses are, but the verses with that Steve Gadd sort of slinky snare beat, he was just sort of goofing on that in between takes, and everybody sort of looked around and they decided to roll tape and do the verses in that feel. At least that's the story I've heard. So it was never intended to be like that, but because, you know, this little thing happened in the studio and they trusted it, like you said, they ran with it.
Well, so that's it's kind of a both thing. It's mm-hmm. a both and. You yeah. have to be prepared, yeah. but you can't be locked into that.
And you can't be over prepared too. Like it's weird. There is a fine line because people can get into muscle memory. And that's why it's really good to do pre-production with artists, which my budgets and my time doesn't really often allow that. But if you can, instead of trying to make, let's say there's a drum pattern that conflicts with vocal cadence, and nobody really realizes that until you get it under a microscope in the studio. But the drummer might have muscle memory and might not, like, he or she might say, this is the way I've always played it. I can't play it any other way, and they start to get into their own head, and it just becomes a vicious cycle like that. You can be a little overprepared. You can be a little too, I don't know, by the book. You got to be prepared, or you got to be able to take things as they come and change on the fly. But doing pre-production where you're not spending a dollar a minute in the studio can sort of take the pressure off situations like that. I like to do that when I can, but it doesn't happen that often.
You've worked with a fair number of big names. You've worked with people like Matt Wallace from Maroon 5, and you've worked with Tony Visconti, who has a relationship, or had a relationship, I guess I should say, with David Bowie. What are some of your favorite collaborations that you've been a part of?
I mean, Tony was amazing because I really paid attention to how Tony listened. He would listen to things, he would hear a song, and then he'd immediately rewind the tape and listen again, and listen again. And it really, like, I learned how to pay attention really acutely from watching Tony work. Another example of attention was Warren Brulé. He did a lot of Violent Femmes records, and I worked with him on the Vacation Land record. They were a band in 2003, 2004 in Portland. Warren was really interesting, and I was young and probably too ambitious, and I got really frustrated because something would happen and Warren would just look around the room and he didn't do anything. And I was so, like, gung-ho, I couldn't understand it. And I was the engineer in this session. He was the producer. He's the boss. I am his subordinate. So I can't do anything. And it wasn't until years and years later that I realized he was gauging everybody's reaction. Like, if something happened, he would look around the room to see if people were grimacing or see if people were smiling, see if people were, you know, he was seeing what these succinct moments, how they elicited reactions in listeners, and using that to, okay, if that makes people, even if that makes people uncomfortable, maybe that's a good thing. So that was pretty great.
So it seems like there are as many different types of engineers and producers as there are musicians.
Yep, absolutely. Everybody's got their own distinct style. Maybe the most famous music producer today is Rick Rubin. And Rick Rubin famously doesn't hang out in the studio. He puts people together in a place, lets them do their work, and then comes back maybe once a week. Sometimes he's producing two or three records at the same time. Comes back, says, this is great. What you're doing here is great. What you're doing here, not so great. So do more of this. And is famously hands-off. And then you get guys like Michael Beinhorn, who are incredibly hands-on. you know, to the point of manipulating instruments, choosing instruments, bringing specific instruments into a session. I think I fall somewhere in between that. I don't like to be super, super micromanagey because I feel like I still want the voice to be that of the band and not of mine. I can't be as hands-off as Rick Rubin.
Well, in this day and age, it seems like we've gone in a direction of following algorithms and having metrics. And I don't know what it's like in the music business. I know what it's like in, say, the field of medicine.
Yeah.
So you follow, if this, then this, if this, then this. You're trying to get certain numbers. I'm guessing there's something similar in music. But there is some, if you always only ever follow an algorithm, then how do you get to a place where you develop your own style?
Yeah, it's true. And I think that there are things like that. And you make me think about this phenomenon that's happening. And it's more with mastering than it is with anything. But I'm sure that the same technology could be applied to mixing. It's basically you can upload a track to a computer and the computer will analyze the frequency response of the content and the dynamic range response and will, you know, without a human being ever touching it, will master a song. And I've heard a few of the results and it's terrible. You know, it's not really that good. I think that, you know, I'm sure that for some things metrics and algorithms work. I don't think that's something that I pay attention to. At the risk of sounding hippy dippy, it's a feel thing, and I seldom even, you know, use meters anymore because I know what things sound like, and I know I can tell already using my ears that, oh, I'm hitting my compressor a little too hard. I don't need to see a VU meter lighting up to tell me that anymore.
So for those of us who don't have as much musical background, what is the difference between engineering and mastering?
Sure. Well, so the two big dichotomies from my world are like engineering and producing. And engineering is the translation of a performance into some sort of storage medium. And it's a technical but artistic endeavor because you can affect that capture using different microphones, using different microphone techniques, using the relationship of the room to the performer. Producing is more overseeing both the creative side of it and the organizational and logistical side of it. You know, as a producer, you're responsible for delivering the record and saying, okay, on this day, we're going to be done and this record is going to come out. And it doesn't always, in my world, it also involves being the engineer. Because I like engineering and it's just one more tool to get the aesthetic I'm looking for. So within that, you've got basically, let's call it, three different stages. A recording engineer who is capturing performances from artists on the floor. And then the next, not, maybe not the next step, but the next big step is mixing, where you take all of these multiple tracks, because when you're recording, you record, let's say, a kick drum to one track and a snare drum to another track and a bass guitar to another track. The mix engineer's job is to blend all of those disparate tracks into a cohesive whole, into the song, and to do that both in a technically pleasing manner and an emotionally convincing, you know, you want to convey emotion, you want to bring the listener along for the ride over the course of the song. And finally, the last step is mastering. That's not something I do. But mastering is it's almost like, you know, the final glossy finish, the last layer of lacquer on a piece of furniture, or it's at Gateway they describe it as it's the last creative step in making a record and the first technical step in producing whatever is going to go to the consumer, whether that's a compact disc or these days a download or a streaming file. Mastering excuse me, you don't have as much control. You can't in mastering say, oh, I wish the vocal were louder, or I wish that the guitars were quieter. You have a fair bit of control over the overall, it's big, broad strokes. But the thing that a mastering engineer does usually is brings perspective. When I'm, and I make records really fast, like rarely do I have more than 2 weeks to make a record. But 2 weeks is a long time to be listening to the same 8 or 10 songs all the time, you know, 60, 70 hours a week in those 2 weeks. The mastering engineer has the ability to hear those songs for the first time and maybe hear things that I as a mixer missed. And again, you know, I work fast, so maybe one song is a little bass heavy. Maybe one song is a little dull. Maybe one song doesn't, the choruses don't explode the way they could. And the mastering engineer's perspective, for as a more or less a first-time listener, gets to modify that, gets to, again, say, what's the very last thing that this needs to put it over the top?
Well, I have learned a lot during this conversation. It's really very, it's good stuff, because I'm lucky I have Spencer Albee to do all of the stuff.
Yes.
To bring the radio show out there. All I have to do is talk. So my job's relatively easy. I'm going to refer people who have been listening and want more information about the work you're doing to our Love Maine Radio show notes page, where we will put your website.
Awesome.
So that they can find you here in the Portland, Maine, not
yes.
Portland, Oregon.
But if you're from Portland, Oregon, we can still do stuff.
That's okay, too. I've been speaking with Jonathan Wyman, who has spent most of his adult life in recording studios and now operates out of the Halo Recording Studio in Windham. Thanks so much for educating me, for coming in today, and for the work that you're doing.
Right on. Thank you for having me.